Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Selfish, shallow, self-absorbed. Those are some of the stereotypes that are associated with those who consciously choose to forego parenthood. But my next guests say the reasons behind this decision are far more complex and diverse, and that adulthood presents many other opportunities to be responsible, productive, compassionate, and nurturing to kids that don't have to be your own. Megan Daum is an essayist, novelist, and editor of the new book, Selfish, Shallow, and Self-Absorbed, 16 Writers on the Decision Not to Have Kids. Megan, by the way, will be hosting the launch of the book tomorrow night at 7 at the Housing Works bookstore on Crosby Street in Soho. And also with us is Tim Kreider, one of the writers who contributed an essay to the book. He's also a cartoonist and author of We Learn Nothing, Essays and Cartoons. So welcome back, Megan Daum, and welcome to WNYC, Tim Kreider.
Thank you.
Megan, why collect 16 writers on this topic? Are there that many reasons not to want kids?
Oh, there are more reasons than you can imagine. You know, one of the reasons I really wanted to do this project, and I'd wanted to do it for a very long time, is I felt like a lot of the discussion around this issue tends to get reduced to these kind of glib retorts, like, oh, I forgot to have kids, or I'd rather sleep late, or I'd rather take expensive vacations. And I don't think those are the reasons anyone makes this choice. I think it's a really serious one. And for some reason, it just keeps getting reduced down to who's more selfish and brats and breeders and all this kind of thing. And I just really wanted to get past that and have a thoughtful discussion.
Yeah. I mean, in February, we did a segment about Pope Francis's statement that not having children is a selfish choice, and that societies that view children as a worry or a burden are depressed societies. I'm going to play a clip from one of our listeners who called in to discuss that.
Previous generations had an expectation that we would pass on the good things in the world to future generations, and concomitant with that is past generations had an idea that we were going to pass on children who would enjoy that world, and otherwise their striving would have been for nothing. I think it's a moral obligation, whether you're religious or not. Even in reading the concept of the public trust doctrine in American law, on its face, it assumes there will be people to enjoy the bounty of nature that we're supposed to protect.
Does that make you – I saw your face. Does that make you cringe when somebody says, whether you're religious or not, it's a moral obligation to have children?
I think it's a moral obligation to live in the world in the way that you can best live in the world. Children need to be in communities where people aren't forced into certain decisions, and people need to be good citizens. And if being a parent is not what you want to do, I can't think of a worse way to be not a good citizen than to do it anyway.
And talking about this in a religious context, Tim, you write in your essay in the book that, I gather you once described being a parent as like belonging to a cult.
Yes, being beholden to a demented and capricious master, subject to appalling conditions of degradation and filth.
Luckily, is that in short why you didn't want to become a father?
I don't think it was a decision on my part. It simply never occurred to me that I might ever want to do that. And frankly, I doubt it's a decision on most people's part. I don't think most people are motivated by rationality.
Well, what do you mean it just simply never occurred to you? Didn't you ever – I don't know what your relationship status is, but – at some point,
I'm
you probably
not going to talk about it on air.
He's going to get a lot of women calling him after this interview, clearly.
Most guys, whether you're getting involved with men or women, are probably at some point going to wind up hearing, well, do you want to have kids? I want to have kids, or I don't want to have kids. So it couldn't have just not occurred to you, right?
It's not like the possibility was never broached, but it certainly never occurred to me that it was anything I wanted to do. It simply was not something I ever struggled with. I never liked babies, even when I more or less was one. They seem loud and messy and sort of coated with this film of mucus. I didn't want one.
Oh, you say those are negative things.
Well, to go back to the religious issue, in my own essay, I sort of suggested some things as vague inklings, which it turned out the novelist Lionel Shriver discussed way more articulately and in detail in her essay. I mean, she thinks that people's increasing reluctance to have children is a sort of existential crisis in the West. People are less concerned with community and with continuity in the future than they are with, well, whether their lives are interesting and fun. And children are a lot of things. I think that they make your life more meaningful and fulfilling, but they certainly don't make it more fun.
What was your reason, Megan, not to want kids?
Well, some of the same reasons. It just never felt like the right path for me. I feel like I do have things to contribute, actually. But that just isn't one of them. And it kind of felt like I feel like I would love my children if I had them, but I wouldn't necessarily love my life. And I wanted to, you know, in bringing all these essays together, they're all very different. There are 13 women and 3 men, and everyone comes at it from a very different point of view. Some people were ambivalent. Some people always knew. Some people are very funny. Some people are, you know, there's a certain grieving that even goes along with this choice, even when it's absolutely the right one. So I guess for me, I feel like I can contribute more effectively in other ways.
So listeners, if there are 16 essays in this book with, let's say, at least 16 reasons not to want children, you can call up and create a list. 212-433-WNYC if you're in that category. If you're not in that category, call up and say or ask anything you want. 212-433-9692 for the writer Megan Dom, whose new book is As an Editor, collecting writers on the topic of not wanting children. The book is called Selfish, Shallow, and Self-Absorbed, 16 writers on the decision not to have kids. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And to be clear, this is about people who've decided that they don't want children. This is not,
yes,
living with your miscarriage or anything,
right,
like that.
Right. Now, this is very much, yes, people who've made that decision.
Are there gender differences in either the reasons that you find, Megan, that people don't want children, or in the reaction to it? We started to talk about this off the air before we went on, Tim, and I wouldn't call it a theory. It's not that strong. But I wonder if a man who states flat out that he doesn't want kids is looked down on even worse than a woman who decides that is. You know, I'm thinking like, a woman has more of an excuse. She's the one who's going to be burdened by the pregnancy, by the childbirth, mm-hmm, by having to do the bulk of the parenthood in most relationships. A man who says, nope, I don't want kids, he can really be written off as a lifelong adolescent. What do you think?
Well, you used the word dismissed earlier, and that might be accurate. I mean, I think it's easier to dismiss a man as simply an arrested adolescent. But I think that the disparity in numbers and gender in this book alone,
mostly women,
speak to, yes, it's only 3 men in a book of 16 writers. And I think that speaks to how much more women have to wrestle with this issue. Like, frankly, being dismissed as adolescent isn't the worst thing that can happen to you. And I think there's at least a sort of social template for that kind of guy, like the irascible bachelor, W.C. Fields. You know, it's well known among my friends that I have no fondness for children. So no one ever asks me to hold the baby. I'm sure, an endearing part of my persona. But I think if you're a woman and you don't want kids, the reaction, it goes a little deeper. It's as if there is something fundamentally wrong with you.
Because you're supposed to have a maternal instinct, and guys don't necessarily have that expectation, Megan.
Right. And Laura Kipnis, who's one of the contributors, writes an essay in the book called Maternal Instincts. And her theory is that this is totally socially constructed, and it's not something everyone's going to agree with. And that's very much her theory. But it is something people have thought about. I mean, it's like it with women, it always comes down to this idea of what is natural. We are naturally supposed to want to do this. And I want to emphasize, most people are going to want kids. Most people should want kids. This is not a manifesto. I'm not in any way trying to make the case that people shouldn't have kids. All I want to do is reframe the discussion, because I think it has been so mired in stereotypes and just, you know, glib, flippant statements. And this idea that parents and non-parents are adversaries, and that's a media construct that has bled into the into the public consciousness and become conventional wisdom. And I think that's really damaging.
The adversaries are probably the people who decide not to have kids and their parents who want to have grandchildren.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think that the gender balance in your book wound up 13-3 just because that's who's writing about the topic, overwhelmingly women?
Yeah, it seemed like a good ratio to me, actually, because it seemed proportionate to the degree to which men fret about this versus women. I do think that men who don't want to have kids get dismissed in a different way than women do. I think you make a good point that, like, people can sort of understand why it would be a drag for women. But, you know, it's a drag for everybody. It's a hard, important job.
Jim in Manalapan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. I was just going to say, my wife and I, we're very concerned with the ongoing health of the species and the planet, and that we both understand that the survival of the species doesn't rest on me and my wife having a kid. So I think more and more the survival of the species will depend upon having a conversation about the arrogance and the view expressed by the Pope.
Jim, thank you very much. What there is, though, is a bifurcation in the world where there are some countries, mostly developing countries, where they're having a lot of kids and overpopulation is a problem. And most of the countries in the West and Japan that are having not enough kids to equal the replacement rate. And so we get these ratios of, you know, workers to pensioners, and that puts the burden on Social Security. And the only reason we're not in a crisis over that in this country like they are in Europe is because we have so many immigrants who are either children themselves or tend to have children. So, you know, that's probably outside the scope of your book. But in terms of the future of the human race, not depending on the caller and his wife, something larger, at least economically, macroeconomically, does depend on.
Yeah,
people.
It's outside of the scope of the book, but it's implicit in the book. These questions come up, and I do think that I highly doubt that anybody has really chosen not to have a child because they're concerned about overpopulation. Probably they didn't really want to have a child anyway. I would like to meet the person who was dying to have a child and actually didn't because they were worried about
population. No, I think what the caller implies, Tim, is the opposite, that there are people who look at their life choices and say, the future of some social good depends on me having a child. In certain communities, you know, Orthodox Jews have a lot of kids to try to create more larger Orthodox Jewish communities. I don't mean to single out Orthodox Jews because there are others who do that too. But there isn't in our individualistic society much of a thought that there's any community imperative.
Well, I guess it would be depressing to believe that the only way people could feel any investment in humanity or in the future is through people they happen to be biologically related to. That doesn't actually seem selfless at all. It seems very much the opposite. I mean, I do think that there is a sort of lack of sense of connection with the future these days, and that is very worrisome. I mean, issues like climate change depend on our having investment in the future of the species. You know, this is why Ray Bradbury was such a big advocate of space travel. He thought it was our generation's version of cathedral building, a multi-generational project with its eye on something distant and maybe unattainable. It would not be a bad thing if more of us felt that kind of continuity. I mean, I'm ashamed to admit this. It sounds so hubristic, but whenever I write something, I think, would an intelligent person 1,000 years from now be able to understand this? Would they relate to this the way I can relate to Seneca or Thucydides? What a pathetic thing to say. But
really? I was impressed.
Yeah, really. That might be our promo clip for tomorrow. Worthy in Freeport, you're on WNYC. Hello, Worthy.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I think a lot of this also deals with the cost of living. It is very expensive today. More so, I was born in 1962. The world is a much more expensive place than it was for my parents. And I think that young people like me, I'm 52, so I'm talking about people younger than me, maybe looking at the cost of living and delaying marriage and delaying all of that, and maybe they delay it to a point where it just never happens. Because everything is just so expensive in comparison to our parents' generation that is making people think about the cost.
And if you look far enough back, having kids was kind of an economic imperative. If you think about an agricultural society where you needed the, you know, the physical hands on deck, it's completely flipped in the modern world, in this country at least, to being a financial burden.
Yeah, it's completely – the inverse is true now. You know, one of the thoughts that I find really interesting around this comes from the psychologist Jerome Kagan, and he was actually cited by Jennifer Senior, who wrote this wonderful book, All Joy and No Fun, about parenting, and she is a parent, and it's – you know, it kind of talks about this from the other side. But, you know, the cost of living aside, raising families has become this kind of performative act. I mean, we have Facebook has become this medium for curated representations of family life, and we're showing everybody how happy we are and how affluent. And Kagan's idea with all of this, not particularly, you know, referring to Facebook, is that this has become a way of showing how moral we are, showing our kind of civic virtue. And in lieu of people going to church or becoming, you know, involved in their communities, the nuclear family becomes this vessel for kind of showing off our virtue. And I think that kind of is part and parcel with the cost of living. And it's kind of a more nuanced version of that. But it's certainly something I notice.
Megan Daum, editor, Tim Kreider, contributor to the book Selfish, Shallow, and Self-Absorbed, 16 Writers on the Decision Not to Have Kids. Tim, you wanted to say?
Oh, there's an argument, maybe more polemical than I'm willing to make on the air, that people's devotion to their families ultimately makes them more selfish and make decisions at the expense of the larger community.
Oh, we did this conversation last week on the show.
I missed it.
Yeah. I mean, my pet theory, why education's a failure in the U.S. is because no one really cares about kids. They only care about their kids.
And that's exactly the call-in that we did. When do you abandon – there was a good essay in The Atlantic about it that prompted it. You know, when do you abandon your local, diverse, but meh public school to put your kid in some gifted and talented program that he or she qualifies for, thereby further making the local public school meh?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And is it, you know – that parenting connects us to the community, or is that parenting makes us more selfish?
And it's
a big question.
When it comes down to your own family, you can't know until you get to that moment. I mean, I certainly wouldn't sit here and if I was in that situation, I don't know what I would do.
Susan in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Brian. Thanks so much for taking my call. I love the show.
Thank you.
I am in an unusual role in that I am a single, about to turn 50, and have no children, but I'm very close with my two godchildren, with whom I've been involved since they were born. And the complexities of trying to make that work are kind of as challenging as any marriage or any situation where parents are divorcing and co-parenting, and I think that's another issue that has to be raised in this context. I'm also a therapist, and I work with a lot of couples who are struggling to parent well in the current environment. And our society does a really bad job of supporting them. And, you know, all of these things have to do with complex combinations of personal and social criteria that a lot of us don't feel in control of. And, you know, already there's been mention of economic things. But the personal things are important, too, issues of power, issues of motherhood. And to add to your guests' longing for Thucydides, you know, we're just starting to see literature by women about motherhood and the complexities of it. And I think that will change the conversation as well. And I'll go off the air to hear your response.
I think, Susan, as a therapist and somebody who brings up lack of community support, I wonder if you find a tension among a lot of parents who you see that, you know, on the one hand, they want their autonomy. Everybody in our individualist society wants their autonomy. They don't want to live in the same house as their parents or any other definition of autonomy that you want to look at. But then being a parent in a nuclear family is so isolating in this society that it adds to the burden.
for people coming to parenthood later in life to reconcile the freedom they've had. You know, we have a very uncritical idea of freedom in this country, and this relates to some of your previous guests today as well.
Yeah.
But we don't talk about the difficulties of freedom, the difficulties of putting yourself aside once you've developed a taste for and a habit for me time. I hear that from my clients a lot. What about me? And they want to be good parents, but they don't necessarily have good models. A lot of people come from homes where the marriages were not very successful, and they don't know what it means to, you know, commit to a long-term relationship and make the sacrifices mm-hmm. that make that mm-hmm. work. So we're in the midst of changing models, and that's going to be difficult for everyone. And I don't think we really talk about that very much. I also think there's a great book, I'm forgetting the title, but, you know, this is all more inside baseball for therapists. But we're starting to talk about interdependence as a psychological need.
Yes.
And we tend in our quest for freedom to forget that we all have dependency needs as well, and they don't go away just because we grow up and put on the mantle of being independent
grown-ups.
Adults.
Susan, thank you so much for your call. See, Tim, don't you like the fact that you can say Thucydides on the show and somebody will call up and relate to it?
That is nice. I had someone give me a thumbs up when they saw me reading Thucydides on the subway once. That was nice.
So the book is called Selfish, Shallow, and Self-Absorbed, 16 Writers on the Decision Not to Have Kids. Kids. The editor is the well-known essayist and novelist Megan Daum. She will be hosting the launch of the book tomorrow night at 7 at the Housing Works bookstore on Crosby Street in Soho. Also with us has been contributor Tim Kreider, also a cartoonist and author of We Learn Nothing, Essays and Cartoons. Tim, it's good to have your funny voice in the book. I'm sure you think that, Megan.
I was a huge fan of Tim's writing, so I was thrilled to get him in the book.
What's one essay you like in the book besides your own?
I like Lionel Shriver's very much, and I was also going to talk up Laura Kipnis's essay, which is a good deal more intellectually rigorous than my own.
Thanks for starting the conversation.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we're going to get details of the emerging New York State budget agreement. Let's see. No Dream Act, no minimum wage increases, not sure whether 50% of teacher evaluations will now be based on their students' standardized tests. That remains vague so far. We'll try to clear it up with Jimmy Vielkind from Capital New York. Ethics rules for state legislators, yes. We'll see how strict. And, oh, there's some money in the budget, too. Stay with us.